At Highland, we're all about celebrating little wins and little ways to innovate digital processes. There's no customer pain point too small for us to help with. Maybe that's why more than half of the Fortune 100 looks to Highland to connect their content and data, improve processes, and turn little efficiencies into big wins for their customers and clients. Highland, intelligent content solutions for innovators everywhere at highland.com.
The Future Proof Podcast from Newstalk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof the Podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. My name is Jonathan McRae. Before we kick into the usual business of the day, massive congratulations to the BT Young Scientist winner, Gregory Tarr from Bandon Grammar School in Cork. It's such an amazing achievement to win that competition because the level of science that these students apply often is world class, not just amongst students, but amongst adults as well. Gregory applied his mind to a very important task, figuring out deep fakes, which are doctored videos on the internet, often using very complicated AI to make it look like Barack Obama or Donald Trump is saying something that they're not, and really, really dangerous technology if in the wrong hands to promote propaganda or pipe out fake news. Really, really important to try and figure out what's real and what's not real. And that's what Gregory was trying to do. The current methods of detecting these deep fakes really are not deployable because they're too clunky. He, in fact, figured out a way to speed up the process of figuring out what's fake and what's real by a factor of 10, and is a very well deserving winner in a long line of deserving winners. Congratulations to everyone of the BT Young Scientist, both all of the students who took part in this year of years, as well as those organizers who do an amazing job every year. Right, coming up on this week's podcast, we're going to be speaking to Lawrence O'Toole, the space engineer from the European Space Agency, a Mullingar man, who is tasked the problem of finding a needle in a haystack, a tiny lander that had traveled 4 billion miles to land on a comet and got lost. And we'll be hearing his story in a few minutes' time. If you'd like to email us, science@newstalk.com. You can find us on Twitter or at Newstalk Science. We'll get to all of those comments at the end of the podcast from last week. But first, it's time to look back at the week's science news. And we're joined by Drs. Jessamine Fairfield from NUI Galway and Dr. Shane Bergen from UCT. Happy New Year, folks. Happy New Year, Jess. Long time no speak.
Yeah, it's great. Great to be back in a year that's not 2020.
Yeah, big time. Although 2021 is quite 2020-ish so far. You have a gig coming up This is something that works really well, I think, online. Some of the stuff that you see adapted for online doesn't work very well, but Bright Club is a perfect thing to do. Tell us about Bright Club.
Yeah, that's right. So we're running our first Bright Club event of the year next week online, January 13th. And, you know, Bright Club, for those that don't know, is basically a variety night that brings together science and comedy and cutting edge research. These used to be live events, but now they're online. And it's actually really nice because it means we can get speakers from anywhere in the country and they don't have to be physically somewhere. In fact, we get a lot of people from the UK and the US as well. We've got a historian this week. We've got a musicologist as well as a biologist, as well as Ellen Tiernan headlining, who's always a very hilarious headliner.
Oh, great.
And studied as an engineer, which is a fact that I didn't know until recently. So yeah, we're really excited to have more Bright Club events online this year because I think just everyone needs something that's fun and nice.
Brightclub.ie?
Brightclub.ie, exactly.
Yeah, no, it's an excellent format. So check it out, brightclub.ie. What day is that, Jess?
That's on Wednesday the
13th. Wednesday 13th. All right, let's take a look at this week's science news. Shane, our first story. Is about how we know where we're going.
Yeah, which seems to be a huge issue for a lot of people that I encounter on my daily walk. So, like, I'm not really fond of people getting in my bubble at the best of times. But right now, I'm kind of practically at the stage of bringing a hurley stick with me when I go walking. So people kind of keep that 2 meter distance from me. So neuroscience has been published this week in Nature from scientists at the University of California in Los Angeles. And they've been looking at what our brains do in order for us to know where we are and, importantly, where other people are relative to us. And they've piggybacked on some other research in order to do this. So they've been working with people who have epilepsy. Now, the fact that they have epilepsy is completely secondary to this study. But because of their epilepsy, these people have electrodes that have been surgically implanted in their brains. The electrodes are there to control their seizures. But the researchers in UCLA have decided, that's really handy because now we have a way to actively monitor their brain waves in real time as they're moving around, say, a room or a street.
Yeah.
And so they've wired them up and they have backpacks on and they're connected to the temporal lobe, which we know is associated with memory and we think is associated with navigation. And they're looking at the activity of the temporal lobe when people are moving about. And so they've done a number of controlled experiments. The first one, people are put into a previously unknown room and there's other people in there with them and they're moving around. And the second thing is then they're told to try and find a hidden spot in the room. And what they found was that the activity for that's going on in the temporal lobe for us figuring out where we are on our own is identical to us figuring out what other people are doing. So basically, they're postulating that from a kind of a brain point of view, we step into other people's shoes to figure out how they're moving around. So we have to imagine what they're going to do next based on what we do next. And that's how we keep away from each other and figure out what other people are going to do. And it's really important, not just from the point of view of figuring out what queue to go in when you're in Tesco, as in which one's going to move fastest, but also say like things like, are you able to cross the road? Or are you able to jump and catch something that's coming towards you being thrown by somebody else?
Yeah. It'd be really interesting to have a look at basketball players and see what level of activity they have in the temporal lobe, because the court awareness of some of these players, I don't know if you've ever played basketball, Shane. It's one of those sports where you need sort of 360 degrees awareness a lot of the time. And it doesn't surprise me that our brains are tracking other people in space. But what really did raise an eyebrow for me was that even if the participants in this study were sitting down, their brain was active in the same way as if they were moving when they were watching someone else navigate around, which I thought was really, really interesting. So our brain sort of actively keeps an eye on other people's movements and imagines where they're going. And that is obviously useful for sensing threats as well.
There is, but there's one extra in this paper that I think is important for COVID, right? Which is that if you're concentrating, the function of that part of the brain increases dramatically. So when they were looking for the hidden spot, the activity in the temporal lobe increased. So I've always wondered, are the sort of people who bump into people all the time, are they just like kind of not that conscious of where they're going and what they're doing? So I wonder if we pay a little bit more attention when we're out and about, are we actually better able to avoid bumping into people and give people the space that we
Stop
all create?
Stop lecturing my listeners, Shane.
I can give the roads that I walk on, if that helps.
Jess, our second story is a slightly worrying one that presumably is some sort of hangover from the Trump administration. This is a story that Alaska is being opened up for oil exploration.
Yeah, that's right. This is a story that could be put in the category of terrible things that my country of origin is still doing, which I hope that category will have a lot fewer stories soon. But this is about a goal of the Trump administration from early on, which was to open up the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in Alaska to drilling and oil and gas exploration. And even though we're almost right to the end of that administration now, they have managed to hold the first sale of oil leases in that wildlife refuge just this last week. Obviously, this is a huge concern in the sense that the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, if you're not familiar with the geography of Alaska, this refuge is basically close to the northern edge. So it's right on the Arctic Ocean, kind of close to the Canadian border. And the reason why it's important is that it's a huge landscape for polar bears forming their dens in the winter. It also has one of the largest porcupine caribou herds in the world. And it's becoming more and more important, actually, due to climate change, because the sea ice in the Arctic is melting more and more every year. There's reduced sea ice available for bears and other animals to live on during the winter. And so the land there is becoming more and more important. But, you know, some people don't care about that. They just care about financing ill-conceived tax cuts. And that's what, unfortunately, this is about. So these are oil and gas leases that have just opened up. Now, the good news here is that actually there wasn't that much interest in buying them. So that was kind of nice to hear because, you know, as you can imagine, this is a very remote area. It's really hard to get to. It'd be very expensive to look for oil and gas there. And, you know, in terms of the payoff, there might not actually be much. You're sort of gambling in a way. And so I was heartened to hear that not that many of these leases were actually sold this week. And most of them were sold to the state of Alaska.
Who hopefully will just sit on them. I mean, it's sort of a Mr. Burns-esque sort of caper to be drilling in the Alaskan, like the nature reserve, essentially.
Let's hope it's not really activated much. No, and you know, it could, of course, have terrible consequences for both the environment and the native peoples that live there. The obvious long-term solution here, right, is to get a more permanent protection for these kind of areas that are so important, you know, not just to the U.S., but to the entire world, because all of our climate is connected. And I'm also heartened by the fact that President-elect Joe Biden has said he'll nominate Deb Haaland, who's actually from my home state of New Mexico, as the Secretary of the Interior. She's very anti-Arctic drilling. She's actually also a member of the Laguna Pueblo, so she's a Native American and would be the first person, first Native American woman to hold that post. And I'm really hoping that she's able to get through some protections for these kind of things that then won't depend on who the current administration is, because, you know, these are resources that are going to matter for the rest of our lives.
Shane, from How We Know Where We're Going to Which Way Is Up?
Yeah. More work from on the brain area, this time from psychologists working in the University of York. And they've been wondering what happens when your brain can't tell which way is up. So when we're going around the world, as well as noticing where everyone is from the first story, we also have to be aware of what way is down. So if we drop something, what way will it fall? Will gravity act? And we're constantly making decisions between the force of gravity versus, say, propulsion forces from humans or animals, which can move counter to gravity. What happens is sometimes people can go into a low gravity situation like outer space and become very, very confused about which way is up, down, left and right.
Well, one of those situations is, of course, if you're caught in an avalanche, and if you ever get avalanche training, the issue is once you're tumbled down in fresh snow, you really can often have no idea which way is up. But of course, which way is up is very, very important. And so they say, you know, figure that out first before you start digging, because you can exhaust yourself trying to figure out which way is up.
So it seems that there's two types of people. Some people are very good at intuitively knowing, and others who rely perhaps more heavily on visual cues can become easily confused.
Right.
And that's what's happened in this this story. So the research looked at people who were given a VR set, a virtual reality set, and they were put horizontal on a bed. And they put on the headset, and the headset sort of visually cued them to think that they were standing upright. So they were kind of 90 degrees out of phase.
Right.
And for one group of people, they really did believe that they were standing up. But for others, they could figure it out. Now, I think the test for this would be, have you ever gone to, say, like Universal Studios or a place like that where they have these new roller coasters that are built using virtual reality?
Yeah.
Some people really get into it and kind of feel they believe it, as it were.
Yeah.
And sit there and go, this is just like, I might as well be watching television. So I think it is the you're falling into either camp based on how you react to those things.
Yeah, there's a perception sense that we have that isn't one of the five senses called proprioception, and it's our sense of where our body is. And of course, VR very much plays on this, and there's great research. Balan Jalal, we've interviewed a couple of times over the year, using the rubber hand illusion. You can get people to think that their body is not where they think it is. And people who have poor proprioception, I imagine, would probably also be those sort of people who can't discern which way is up.
Well, it's called visual reorientation illusion. And so they're saying that understanding what's happening in people's heads from this study can be helpful for designers of virtual reality. And perhaps grasping at straws, they also say it could be helpful for future lunar missions or for astronauts landing on asteroids. I guess it's a way to figure out who should we send, who should we not send.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, it's tricky enough being an astronaut, but if you can't figure out which way is up, then perhaps that should be one of the first questions on the sheet, right? Jess, very quickly, our final story has to do with gene editing in mice.
Yeah, and it's an exciting story because it's a new study that's indicating that there might be a new way to treat progeria, which is a really horrible disease that causes premature aging in children. It basically comes from a single change in a gene in the body that then just creates this abnormal protein that messes up the membrane around the nucleus of the cell. So obviously this causes issues for tissues throughout the body. Children that have this disease have stunted growth, they have osteoporosis, artery diseases, things that you would associate with much older people. And the life expectancy for progeria victims is only about 14 years. But this new technique of base editing, which is kind of similar to CRISPR, but editing one strand of the DNA instead of both strands of it, has been used in mice, as you said, to help reduce a lot of the effects of progeria and, in fact, reverse them in some cases. So it's exciting because this horrible disease just comes from this one base mutation. But the base editing process that they've developed, these are researchers from Harvard and Vanderbilt universities in the U.S., it's administered to the mice when they're only about 2 weeks old, which is only about 5 in human years. So the age at which in a kid you would know that they had it, it actually was able to reduce the heart-related effects of progeria, as well as slowly propagate into about 20 to 60% of the other cells in their body over about 6 months. So it's really exciting. Obviously, there's a long way to go to human trials and things like that. Lots of issues around gene editing in people to actually address these kind of diseases. But it's a really, really exciting new process.
Yeah, it's an awful condition, something that we haven't covered on the program. And I think from a scientific point of view and a medical point of view, it's probably a really interesting one to explore, but great to see some sort of light on the horizon. Dr. Jessamine Fairfield from NUI Galway, from UCD, Dr. Shane Bergen, thanks as always. Yes, you're welcome back to Future Proof on News Talk. I'm Jonathan McRae. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can email us science@newstalk.com, or you can find us on Twitter. We're at News Talk Science. Now, on Wednesday next, January the 13th, the STEM Southwest Expo, which is stemsouthwest.ie, is taking place, and Lawrence O'Rourke will be speaking at it. Lawrence is a Mullingar man who was the person who the European Space Agency turned to when they couldn't figure out how they lost the lander that had flown 4 billion miles to catch up with a comet and land on it. It was an extraordinary mission that culminated about 5 years ago, called the Rosetta mission, something we covered quite a lot on this program. So delighted to have him on the program to speak with you now. Lawrence, can you tell me about when you first started working on the mission and how much faith you had in the mission at the beginning? Because it did sound really, really ambitious.
Well, I mean, there's no doubt that when it comes to space missions, you're always trying to push the limits and to achieve what sometimes might seem the impossible. And Rosetta was always a mission which looked like you were trying to achieve the impossible. And I got involved in a mission already when I was working in Germany. I was on the flight control team that helped to operate the spacecraft after it separated from the launcher. So I was involved already before launch. And then I left Rosetta nearly 6 months or so after we launched. I moved on to other missions. And I returned again about 2011, 2012, just to prepare the system to be ready for when we arrived at the comet. And so we arrived at the comet, we arrived in 2014. So you can imagine it took 10 years to try to rendezvous with this comet, which is already quite a long time. So you're building a satellite to be in space and work in space for many, many years. So you need a lot of what's called redundancy. You need a lot of backup to the backup in order to be able to ensure that if anything fails, you can deal with this long trip and this long length of time. So I joined again in 2012. And then when we arrived in 2014, well, the initial months were all about trying to map the comet and try to identify the location for landing Philae, this lander of a washing machine-sized object weighing about 100 kilograms that landed on the surface of the comet. And we did that in November 2014, which already seems like a long time ago.
Yeah.
But it landed, and certainly it was. It went. The whole experience went beyond our expectations. We certainly did the impossible when we arrived, and we're really thrilled to see the response from the public when we landed and what happened afterwards.
What was it like getting confirmation that you'd reached and then landed on the comet as someone who'd been involved in it for over 10 years?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of these fulfilling moments, you know, where you spend so much time, so much effort and energy, nights and days, weekends, putting your inner self into a project, and then to see it come to fruition, well, it's extraordinary. I mean, we did land on a comet, and I was in the control center, the lander control center, when we landed. What we didn't expect was that it would bounce. And it did bounce, and it crossed the surface because the harpoons, which we'd had installed for it to actually release and hold onto the surface, well, they didn't work. So it bounced and crossed the surface. And it touched down twice more. And then the third touchdown, it landed underneath a cliff. And this is where we were still in contact with it. We just didn't know where it was. And it really took us nearly 2 years to find it afterwards.
Which is amazing, because of course, you no matter how many instruments you have and images you have, it is very tricky to do all of this work from so far away and with limited things that you can do with both the lander and the orbiting satellite. Tell me about some of the challenges that lay ahead when you first realized you had to find this lander. What sort of thinking did you have to apply to find this this lost probe?
I mean, we had some clues. One of them was that we had more or less an area on the comet where it had to have been. The problem was that area is just covered by cliffs, by boulders the size of houses. So it was, and you're talking about something which is very small, hidden, let's say a needle in a haystack. And so trying to find it was a difficult task. But like anything, if you know that it's located in an area, well, then what you want to do is you want to take do a 360 degree view of this area. Take images from all directions and try to get as close as possible. And this was the biggest challenge we faced really when it came to Rosetta, was that we were flying on a comet. And the comet is a body made of ice and dust. As it gets closer to the comet, the ice just sublimes, it changes to gas. The dust trapped in it is pushed out, and you're effectively dealing with clouds of gas and dust which are blowing and pushing Rosetta away. And so it creates a lot of danger for the mission. So we really couldn't get close again until about 2016. And when we started getting close, then, okay, I led the campaign to work out the different images, imaging campaign, let's say, to try to look from all directions and to, let's say, hone in on this location. So we found what you could call multiple landers, because a lot of things shine on the comet. I mean, it's ice. There's ice trapped inside. A lot of things which maybe look like landers. And so the end of the campaign came when we actually could finally get that one image on the 2nd of September 2016 of showing Philae on its side in the lander. But it was quite an engineering effort and a lot of imagery, a lot of late nights, early mornings, weekends, but delighted to see the image being taken.
Why was it important to find Philae, the lander that had sort of tumbled across the surface of this comet? There was some interesting data you'd gotten and you needed to sort of find the lander to sort of understand it. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, you're dealing with context. Basically, you're dealing with an object which is over 4 kilometers in size. And what I mean by context is we've taken scientific measurements in a certain location, And even one of those measurements is you've actually been able to send radio waves through the comet to actually see what's inside the comet. But where exactly are you located on the surface? Where did you send these radio waves from? Because that only gives you then, once you know where it is, then you know at least what the internal structure is close to that, in that location, underneath where the lander is. And so it's very important to find it to contextualize the science we got. But what I think is more interesting to add to all of this is that, I mean, when Philip crossed the surface, it bounced, and it bounced twice. Let's say it crossed, had a touch, a second touchdown, and then one last bounce again and landed in its final location. And the middle location, it's called touchdown two, was never found. And so this is where my talk in the STEM talk next week is focuses on. It's where I found, it's called the touchdown 2 point, and I was able to show that Philly had actually sliced through two cometary boulders, exposing ice inside, an ice which was about 4.5 billion years old. Philly had actually left its impression of its surface in the ice, so you actually see a triangular shape made that belongs to Philly. And the compression that was made by Philly, which is in some ways you're checking the compressive strength, it's a mechanical engineering sort of task. Well, we were able to determine that too, and this allowed us to determine that the ice that's on the inside of a comet is softer than the lightest snow that you can actually stand on. It's softer than the cappuccino froth that you have, the froth you have in your cappuccino, on the froth that you see on the surface of the waves in the seashore. That's the ice on a comet, and this is what I've been talking about, which is all the STEM techniques I used to try to locate this secret location and confirm that the ice inside a comet is super soft.
Which is fascinating to me, because you imagine, when you think about, you know, ice traveling through space, you imagine this rocky, compacted surface, but actually the ice that you saw that the lander kind of traveled through is this super light, sort of almost snow-like ice. How did it land then? What does it land on? So there's various consistencies of ice on the comet, or what?
So a comet is full of, it's just a block of ice mixed with dust. It's really this strange mix, but it's also very fluffy. It has a porosity of about 75 to 85%. So it's a bit like a sponge in some ways. You know, when you squeeze the sponge, you notice it's just full of air. You can see it's full of air, just lots of little holes and gaps. And this is what a comet is like. It's just full of lots of gaps. And so what we're looking at really is with Philae, when the dust is released by this gas, it lands back on the surface and the sun compacts it. And so you have areas which are very hard, and a lot of areas which are very soft. Mm. And so what happened is that Philae, it weighs 100 kilograms on the ground here on the Earth, but the gravity on the comet is 100,000 times less than the Earth. So its weight on the comet is 1 gram. You're dealing with a 1 gram object floating around and touching the surface, so it's not making a huge impact. And it's rotating a bit like a windmill, in fact, and slicing through the boundary between the boulders and exposing ice, which has never been seen in the light of day, if you want to call it that. So it's a very unusual sort of location, very strange to actually have been able to find.
As it traveled through this ancient, I mean, how old do you think this ice is?
Well, 4.5 billion years old.
If it's that old, did Philae manage to capture any of it as it tumbled? Were there sensors to tell you anything about that ice as it went through it?
Well, it went through, I mean, if you want to say, it went through quickly. It went through within about 2 minutes, you know. But that's it made four different contacts. It slid down the edge of the front boulder, changed direction, passed between the two boulders, like a gap between them, a crevice, opened the ice, reached a certain end of the crevice, became too narrow, was pushed forward. That's when it compressed the ice, and that's where we have this major result in the Nature paper I published. It bounces out and then keeps going. What we have is a very small amount of data from Philae itself, because you can see tell the temperatures inside the crevice. I mean, it's minus 200 and, let's say, 20 degrees Celsius. Wow. You can know that it's blocking the telecommunication signal, so you don't have a signal. There's no signal between Rosetta and the lander itself during this time period. You get things from an engineering perspective, but there was no science there until the paper, which I published. So it was quite an achievement in itself.
After leaving something like that, something so thrilling, what did you move on to next? What are you working on now?
So I'm working now for the last 2 years or so on a project called Plato. And Plato is an exoplanet searching mission. So what is an exoplanet searching mission? It's a satellite which launched in 2026. So we have 6 years to go, or 5 years to go. And it consists of 26 cameras. And so in total, we're talking about a 2 gigapixel camera that we're launching, which in comparison to your 12 megapixels in your iPhone or whatever, I mean, we're dealing with the gigapixels of the resolution. And we're going to launch this, send it into a place called Lagrange Point, which is a very, let's say, gravitationally stable area between, let's say, in the direction of the moon. And we're going to point at an area of the sky about the size of Orion, of the Orion constellation, for those who know a bit of the constellations. And we stay there, and we stay looking at that space for about 2 years. And why 2 years? Well, 2 years because basically what you're doing is we're looking at stars in that area, which is hundreds and, well, let's say millions, of course, but we're looking at about 200,000 stars that are very like our sun. So we're looking at sun-like stars. And if you want to find a planet like the Earth around a sun-like star, like our own sun, basically you've got to watch for 2 years because it's going to pass in front of that star twice during the 2 years. And then you know what you're dealing with on Earth. And so it's in comparison to a lot of these missions, which talk about having found habitable planets around other stars, Earth-like planets, you've got to look at the star that they're dealing with. They're dealing with what's called dwarf stars, which are nothing like our own sun. And so what Plato is going to do, we're looking at thousands of suns like our own, and we're looking for Earth. So by 2028, I think you're going to find, this mission is going to revolutionize our understanding of how many Earths are out there in the universe.
Well, I can't wait to see the images that come back from Plato. But for now, keep up the good work. Thanks for speaking with us, Lawrence O'Rourke from the European Space Agency, who's speaking at STEM Southwest. It's at stemsouthwest.ie next Wednesday. It's a free event. Check it out. Lawrence, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I remember reporting on that mission 7 years ago, and it was so exciting to watch it unfold in real time. All right, let's have a look at some of your texts and tweets from last week and the week before. Sorry, I just didn't bother over the new year because I was doing things un-future-proof related and I didn't want to be bothered by your texts and emails. So sorry, I'm going to get into them now. We spoke to the brilliant Mara Hart about the sex lives of fish. Really interesting piece. And Donald texted in saying, sex, as Woody Allen says, if it doesn't feel dirty, you're not doing it right. Indeed. We were speaking also with Kip Williams about ostracism, and he was talking about this computer program called Cyberball, where you get three people on a computer, different computers in different rooms, and you get them to toss a virtual ball to each other. And then you see what happens to someone if the other two stop passing to you, and what happens in your brain and how you feel when you're just left out of the game of catch. You'd be surprised at the effect that ostracism can have on our mood and our behavior. Someone texted in saying, so interested. I was on the beach chatting to a girl with two children a while back when a girl of the same age with children took the space on the other side of me. She started talking across me. I had no children. I was completely cut out of the long conversation. It's interesting, isn't it? It doesn't take much for us to feel angry if we're sort of cut out of something. Interesting psychology. And Megan says, lovely surprise to hear Cyberball being talked about on Future Proof. Throwback to exposing my students to Cyberball in a tiny research cubicle for my social exclusion final year research project about 7 years ago in NUI Galway. What did you do with it though, Megan? What have you done now with your knowledge in the world? We spoke to Martha Weiss about caterpillars remembering that they were butterflies, and great response to that, even though we'd already aired it. This is the second time people had the opportunity to hear it. Joe says, listening to Jonathan McRae explore the most interesting question, do butterflies remember when they were caterpillars? The answer is yes, mind blown emoji. And Paul O'Donnell said, heard the piece, metamorphosis really well explained. But Kevin in Old Town wasn't happy. He said, isn't this just stating the obvious? Of course they'll remember. Moths and butterflies that have, as caterpillars, fed on particular types of plants will naturally lay their eggs on those type of plants, e.g. the cabbage white butterfly, which destroys my brassica. Well, Kevin, I'm sorry about your brassica, but I mean, everything seems obvious when you know the answer. But even sometimes the most intuitive things need to be shown to be true to know they're true. And what I hadn't realized before speaking to Martha was that butterflies undergo an almost complete dissolution into goo in the cocoon, leaving only a tiny part of their nervous system remaining before they reconstitute themselves, reassembling as a butterfly, a structurally totally different creature. For me, and obviously the other two texts, I don't think it was very obvious. We were speaking about space exploration, and Kevin Conroy said, this is a question for a program in the new year. Why are we spending money on space and not examining more than 5% of the world's oceans? Yes, Kevin, and I know it's a point that many others have made, but if we take not just military budgets across the world, but how about just the waste, the military waste as a budget across the world, and put that into space and marine exploration, and it would absolutely transform both of those endeavors, because it really does depress me to read some of these numbers that that are invested in twisters and hurricanes and whatever the names are for torpedoes that are very important and are not in any way compensating for something. I don't make the decisions in the world. It's a really good question, but the people who make those decisions are the people with caps and stern looks and twirly moustaches. And they're just not me or my type of people, to be honest, Kevin. According to them, it's really important to buy loads of missiles every year. That's it from us. Hope you enjoyed the podcast. Thanks to the team, Aidan McKelvey, Garrett Mahal, Steve Daunt, Steve McClune is on sound. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday, as always. In the meantime, have a great weekend and look after yourselves out there. It's pretty mental, isn't it? Stay curious.
What does innovation sound like? It sounds like the luxury of being in the moment with your customer, client, or patient. It sounds like having the right information right when you need it. It sounds like being at your best for your customers and your business. Thanks to Hyland's intelligent content solutions that improve digital processes, innovators everywhere are able to do their thing better, whatever that thing is. Now, who doesn't like the sound of that? Hyland, for innovators everywhere, visit hyland.com.